Hip and a lip. Ba 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 ba. From unknown parts of metropolitan New York City, I am the hip and this is a lip.
Yes, good evening, everybody in H&L Nation on this lovely Wednesday evening. This is the 18th day of January. We are a few days away from Championship Sunday. For all those so excited about the end of the NFL season coming up, a wonderful NFL season, yes, indeed. And I hope you're all feeling very chill and H and relaxed this evening as we bring you an hour or so. Who knows? We'll see what happens, indeed. Very scintillating and exhilarating sports talk podcast, indeed.
Right. Yes, as you awkwardly shrug your shoulders and deliver that opening line or response to my opening. All right, we are Hip in the Lip in New York Sports Podcast. You can like us on iTunes. You should like us on iTunes.
Yes,
or follow us on Twitter at Hip in the Lip. That's really the lip just spewing his, you know, media reactionary nonsense to whatever sports topic dominates the day. And so tonight we have plenty to cover here. Indeed. Tonight we have plenty to cover. Four divisional NFL round games to get to. Some more exciting than others. Plenty to discuss. I had a great time watching the games personally. And we'll do a preview of the games coming this weekend. I think they should both be great games. And we definitely are going to touch upon some hockey as a local hockey team's head coach of nearly 7 years was said, all right, bye, today by his organization, a head coach that has been discussed ad nauseum on this podcast. And so
his name's
we have to give its due because today was big news. We'll talk about some Rangers. Henrik Lundqvist is goal happy these days. And, of course, the hipster beer of the week. So, okay, coming full circle. Back to the divisional round. Let's walk through game by game here. So, and we're going to go sequentially. So, you know, Saturday's games were clearly not as close or as exciting, but I think there were some interesting takeaways from them. So starting with Seattle, Atlanta pretty much dominating this one with the final score of 36-20, and Seattle was in comeback mode, putting points on towards the end. So it wasn't even as close as the score indicated. I'll start off the what this game basically did for me was just it epitomized what Matt Ryan has done all year, essentially, is masterfully spreading the ball around and making the most of the talent around him. And just masterfully doing it against a Seattle defense that may not be quite as good as it has been in a few years. No Earl Thomas. That was, no. You know, and you could see the difference in how much worse the Seattle defense has been since Earl Thomas went down earlier this year. Just not the same defense, but look, still, Matt Ryan has done it from, you know, for folks that have not watched him week in and week out, doing pretty much every week. And he was a valuable player, and he looks the regular season, right? I mean, it's easy to look at what's happening now in the playoffs, and we can go into that, but I think I would put my vote for Matt Ryan for the MVP when you look at the whole body of work over the regular season.
He had an amazing regular season coming off of a brutal regular. I mean, he was terrible last year. He was legitimately that bad. And you honestly like wonder like what was going on with him and if he was going to revert back to his typical Matt Ryan form that we've come accustomed to. But you know, I think this game on Saturday, though, went the way both of us expected. I mean, we both thought Atlanta would win. We both thought Atlanta would win going away, and they did. I mean, Seattle is just – this is not a vintage Seattle team. I mean, I know they handled Detroit, but, you know, this is just not the same Seattle team that we've become accustomed to that won the Super Bowl and that got to another Super Bowl and, you know, did it on defense and some, you know, key plays thrown in by their quarterback who was injured all year, kind of had a very uneven season, did Russell Wilson. I think Seattle will be back next year. I think they're going to be pretty good. I mean, they still have a solid core, but not the same Seattle team. And just typical Matt Ryan Atlanta offense as they roll into the championship game this coming Sunday against Green Bay. Of course, we will get into that a little bit later. But game pretty much went the way I expected. I don't know if you thought, if you thought differently, but I mean, we both picked Atlanta to win. And
I picked Seattle. I picked Atlanta to cover, so it went. I expected it to be, I thought it'd be a bit closer than it ended up being.
Maybe I thought it'd be a double digit.
It's just when you look at Matt Ryan's weapons. Look, he has Julio Jones, who this guy like can't play a full set of snaps in a single game. There's almost always something where this guy has to come out. Now it's a lingering toe injury. He didn't practice today. He's going to play, but he always seems to miss snaps. He missed two games this year. He always gets nicked up. And look, the rest of the guys on the team, I mean, Mohamed Sanu, Taylor Gabriel, Aldrick Robinson, rounding in core there. And, you know, Le'Veon Toleo and I don't remember who the other tight end is, frankly. But, you know, after Julio Jones, who, yes, is an incredible wide receiver when he's healthy and on the field, it's just Matt Ryan put them in positions to make plays all year, just doing it perfectly. So, anyway, the season closes on Seattle. And we'll get to the preview of the NFC Championship game, you know, in a bit. But let's move on here to the game in Foxborough. Now, this was a game where Patriots fans were really sweating it out in that first half. I mean, the Houston defense showed up and put a lot of pressure on Brady, and they could not really sustain drives in that first half. And the Texans defense was forcing turnovers. The thing is, I think everybody knew at some point, barring a pick six or something that would really change the momentum of this game, that New England would get their points
take control of the game. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and they did, and
they eventually did. The problem with Houston is Brock Osweiler. I mean, that's really what this comes down to. So this guy,
but he made a few throws though. He didn't get help from his receivers. I will say he made a few on the money throws that were dropped. So I mean, they weren't going to win the game anyway. But I mean, he had a terrible, first half.
But he also made some terrible throws. It was because he didn't have a choice at that point. But here's the thing about Osweiler. So I'm sure other quarterbacks are guilty of it, but I feel like it's just extremely pronounced for him. And these are the things that I get a kick out of when I watch sports. So I noticed that. You know, it's easier to explain when you try to envision a pitcher and a pitcher's motion. Okay, so a starting pitcher starts their motion. You know, usually they have their hand in the glove, and with their hand holding the baseball, right? And then they start the motion. They put their hands back, or above their head, or they kind of swing them to the sides, or get their legs moving, right, to start the pitching motion. And at some point, they start to bring their arm with the ball backwards, right, to start the throwing motion.
Right.
Okay? So you see sometimes baseball pitchers where right before they start that actual throwing motion, they'll tap the ball into the glove. Like it's like a way to like start the motion. It's like to jumpstart the throwing motion, right? So why am I saying all this? You see pitchers do it all the time. So now let's talk about a quarterback and the way a quarterback throws a pass. Brock Osweiler, if you watch one of his throws, it doesn't matter. I would almost guarantee you that he does it on every single pass, other than like a shovel pass. But if it's a full regular throw, what he does is he taps his ball that he's holding against his non-throwing hand right as he's about to start his throwing motion. And he does it so deliberately that I think that it actually adds a lot of time that it takes him from when he starts the motion to when he releases the ball, and his arm motion isn't fast to begin with. It's so elongated that by the time he gets it out, his timing is just harder to be on point with his receivers running their routes.
Yeah,
now, I did notice
– yeah.
Now I watched, but interestingly, in the Green Bay Dallas game, just to point out, Aaron Rodgers was doing it as well, but fast. That his motion is so fast that it's all continuous. But for Brock Osweiler, it's like a deliberate tap. He's like, boom, all right, now I'm gonna start my throw. It's like mentally, that's when the throw starts, is when he's like does that tap against his, you know, it's just it's a throwing motion. It's athletics. It's something that he's probably been doing for all his life. And how are you going to coach a guy to not do that at this point in his career? But I think that's one of those like flaws that can hold a quarterback back from being really crisp. I mean, it just having a slow throwing.
I mean, there's your perfect Tim Tebow. I mean, he had like the worst throwing motion out of any quarterback I've ever seen. You know, it took him a year and a day to get the ball out of his hands, and that's what made him such a terrible thrower of the football. And yeah, I mean, Osweiler is a terrible thrower of the football. Now again, he didn't get much help from his receivers on Saturday, but yeah, Houston's going to learn very quickly that they definitely did not get them find themselves their quarterback of the future, given this guy's $72 million, and he had a terrible regular season. They had to go back to him after Savage got hurt. You know, they benched him and said, "Yeah, we're done with you. You know, we have no more belief in you. We don't think that you can get the job done." In comes Savage. He gets hurt. Brock, come on back. Yeah, we believe in you. Come on. You know, we didn't mean it. So, but you know, they got to the second round. You know, they beat the team they should have beat in Oakland, and they lost to the team that they're just not as good as the Patriots. So, but you mentioned Rodgers, who and we'll, I guess that's going to be next on our dockets of games that we're going through. But I mean, and you mentioned, you know, Rodgers' release and his motion, and it's just, you know, and I mean the quarterback that I would say that is still the quickest, best release I've ever seen is Dan Marino. Dan Marino to me is still the best quarterback I've ever seen. You know, better than anybody, any of the modern quarterbacks, this generational quarterbacks, or anybody that I've ever seen. And he had the best release, just the quickest release, the best, most fluid throwing motion out of any quarterback I've ever seen. But Osweiler, yeah, and it's a good pickup, and that's probably a reason why he has no timing with his receivers, why he misses so many throws, why he's erratic. He's just so inaccurate. And, yeah, I mean, Houston is on their way home. And the Patriots are moving on to their sixth straight AFC championship game in the Belichick-Brady era. They've been so dominant, and here they come again. And everybody's picked to return to the Super Bowl. Yep.
Six straight. Incredible.
Six straight AFC championship games.
Wow. That is unbelievable. Is that a record?
I think
has a team ever gone to that many consecutive conference championships?
It is a record. It either is the record or it tied the record. I forget. I think was it Oakland that had something similar? I think Oakland had. I think they may have tied Oakland for the six consecutive AFC championship game appearances. I think. But yeah, it's
what's the most? All right. So what's the most number of consecutive Super Bowl wins? Three.
Super Bowl wins.
Yeah, how many? What's the most in NFL history? Has the team ever won three straight Super Bowls?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, unless.
So the most has been
Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh won back to back twice. Dallas won back to back. Patriots.
Was there a 4 and 5 years or a 3 and 4 years?
By either of those? Steelers. Well, the Cowboys won 3 and 4 years. Yeah, Cowboys won 92, 93. Sorry, 90.
All right, here's why I ask. I'm wondering.
Yeah, 92, 93, 95. Impressive? Yeah.
What's more impressive, like winning 3 out of 4 Super Bowls, or if that's what Dallas did, or 6 straight conference championship games? I don't know. The just the consistency of getting
Super Bowls. Super Bowls.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that.
It's just so tough to win. It's just so tough to win the Super Bowl, just to get there and win it. We saw the Bills get there 4 times in a row. How about that? The Bills got there 4.
Okay, the Bills got there 4 times in a row. That's obviously more impressive than 6 straight conference championship games. All right, I'll give you that one. I think that is more impressive.
I mean, the Patriots have had an amazing.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to see, like, I'm trying to, like, measure up the significance of that versus other act. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, Belichick is already, I mean, to some, he's the best coach of all time. To some, he is the best NFL coach of all time. Then Doc Rivers said the other day that he's the best coach of all time in any sport, I think. You know, obviously that's very subjective, but you know, that this tandem of Brady and Belichick,
I mean, it's certainly in the conversation at this point with what he's done. You can't argue that.
He's won four. He's on his way to going to his seventh Super Bowl and potentially winning his fifth, if not for the Giants. So, really incredible what that team has accomplished just year in, year out. I mean, they've dominated a pretty weak division. I mean, that division has really never produced another team that could legitimately challenge them, you know, at least consistently throughout like their tenure at the top of the AFC East. But, you know, what they've done is pretty amazing. And, you know, they're on their way to potentially a seventh Super Bowl in the Brady Belichick era.
God. Seventh Super Bowl for Brady and Belichick?
If they win this, they get there. Yeah,
that is incredible.
Amazing. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, we'll get to previewing the game for the Patriots shortly, but let's move to the Sunday's games from this past weekend.
Yes, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Yes.
You know, this clearly was the best game. This was one of those games that, you know, people just won't forget. It was just that amazing, and with the ending and the back and forth. I mean, Peter silencing Cowboys Nation early on with the shots of Jerry Jones looking stunned and, you know, raising the questions. Dak Prescott down 21-10. They were down 21-3.
Yep.
They were down 21-3 in this game.
Yep.
And, you know, Troy Aikman said in the first quarter, I think it was when it was 14-3, 20-3, I don't know. He brought up the Tony Romo, you know. Probably because he was paid to do it.
He couldn't help himself. Hey,
couldn't help himself. He knew it, right?
Back. It's Tony Romo, right? He's on the bench. He's there. Yeah. Bring him in. let him ride into
the sunset. It was 21-3 when he said it, because I made a note to make sure to remember. And look, you can see why, because Dak Prescott had never faced a deficit like this, and we talked about this on the show. What is this? Dak Prescott has just not been tested in that respect at all during the season, where he's been really forced to throw and not rely on Ezekiel Elliott moving the chains. Now, they kept feeding Ezekiel Elliott the rock, and you got to give him credit for that throughout the game, because even when they got down by as much as they did, because they knew they had faith that, you know, they would be able to make plays down the field, because the Green Bay Packers secondary just blows. And so
the defense was atrocious.
Sure enough,
the defense was hideous on Saturday. Oh my God.
It was brutal.
It was brutal.
I mean, chunk gain after chunk gain.
Ugh.
And
guys running wide open in the secondary. It was terrible. Their defense. Oh.
You know, I actually want to ask you a question. Go back to the first quarter in this one. Aaron Rodgers looked like he was just, you know, so mentally into this. And it's what makes watching him so great. Not just the physical talent, but how locked in he looks and how intense he is when he's playing. Okay. And every ounce of his body is just focused towards winning, and there's like no distractions. Right. And so on the first drive for Green Bay, Dallas got caught at 12 men on the field and defensively. And cause Aaron Rodgers hurried up to the line and made sure they snapped the ball when Dallas still had 12 men on the field.
Yeah. I mean, Manning used to do that. Brady does that. The best quarterbacks, they have a knack for that. It's like that, those nuances that those great quarterbacks, they just have a knack for, like, oh, they're substituting very slow. Let's get to the line and see if we can catch them. Yeah. And,
there was a point made by the commentator that, apparently, going into this game, Dallas said that they would smartly make substitutions. Sean Lee is the linebacker
that runs the defense.
Well, I don't understand. That leads to my question. So, what does that even mean?
I have no idea. I mean, smartly make
substitutions. Saying that they would smartly make substitutions, does that imply that there's a decision going into the game whether they're going to make substitutions in the first place? Like, I just didn't really understand what they were getting at.
I mean, the Giants, for example, I mean, they didn't rotate anybody on their defensive line. I mean, they would make substitutions. You know, they had their their base package, they had their nickel, dime, whatever, depending on how many receivers the team, you know, what kind of offense the team was what kind of offensive personnel the other team had on the field. But I don't understand what smartly making substitutions means. You know, if they're running a hurry-up offense, Green Bay, is that what he meant? Obviously, if they're doing that, it's tough to substitute, or you pretty much can't substitute. If they're running a methodical offense where they're huddling and then, you know, Dallas is going to rotate guys in to keep guys fresh or to strategically match up. I don't know what he was talking about there. I'll be honest. I have no idea what smartly make substitutions, what that means. I have no clue.
But all right.
Dallas got caught. Okay. Oh, man. And then they got caught with that other stupid penalty of the guy running, and this is on offense, of course, but the guy running into the huddle and then running out of the huddle and then getting caught with an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty, which is something that you do not see very often. I mean, you'll see 12th man in the huddle, but he wasn't the 12th man. They had the right amount of guys in the huddle. It's just that then, oh, let's get him off the field and bring in somebody else because, you know, we're trying to slip one past the defense there. So, and that's one that you don't see very often. So that's not exactly smartly making substitutions, is that, Troy?
So the game was tied at 28 on when Dez Bryant scored the second touchdown. And then the game gets started in a way. I mean,
pretty crazy.
Dallas came all the way back down 21-3, 28 all, and here's where things just get nuts. So you have that long field goal by Mason Crosby. I think they were set up with better field position on the drive, and then I don't remember, it was a sack or some other play that they got pushed back.
Second down play where they try and run like, and it was almost similar to the Giant game where he made that stupid decision to go for it on fourth down, and then he hands off to Montgomery, and the Giants blow up the play. And, you know, tackle him for a loss. The same thing happened here. He's like trying to run like a little stretch play with Montgomery. Same thing. They blow up the play, Dallas. They couldn't block it properly. And they get knocked back like 5 yards, I think it was. Like, it was just like a stupid play call on third down. You're in field goal range, or you're, you know, trying to potentially maybe score a touchdown there. And as opposed to just settling for a field goal, and then you knock yourself back third and long. And then he has to bail out his coach by kicking a 56-yard field goal.
Unbelievable.
Crosby's great in the playoffs. I mean, he has a fabulous record in the playoffs, but you know, he's not a guy that's known for making those that long of a kick. Usually that's
right. Like, and the kick did not look pretty. It was one of those like wobbly, like, you know.
Like end over end. Yeah, just barely makes it through. The referees even looked at each other like they kind of looked at each other like, was that good? I think it was good, right? Yeah, it was good. And then they eventually put up their arms to signal.
Well, good. I think it's the guy on the upright that is the guy that's below the upright where the ball crosses. Like when it's close to the upright, that's the guy that has the angle. He can see when you're looking straight up at the upright, whether it's inside the upright or outside the upright. The guy that's across on the other side, I don't think that he can really tell. It goes by too quickly. I don't think he could see. I think
it was a quick signal on the game winner. The game winner was a very quick signal for good. But that one, yeah, like,
right, those kicks that are close to the upright, you'll notice that the ref that's under that upright will be the one looked to make the call first, because the other one can't really tell.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then here's where I think, you know, so Dallas now is down 3 with the ball. You know, they score a touchdown and they take the lead in the game. They make some plays down the field. I think they were under 2 minutes.
Guys running wide open. Yeah.
Yep. And so what I think that the drive started with less than 2 minutes to go, but Dallas had at least one timeout. What was interesting is that when they got to about the 30 or so, they spiked the ball, and they still had a timeout, and that decision ultimately ended up killing the Cowboys in this game, because, you know, they don't get the first down, you know, 30 whatever seconds left for Mr. Rodgers to do what he did.
It's a tough call. I mean, I guess it sounds like you felt that it was the wrong call. I think it's debatable. I don't know if it's one that I say that it was obvious that they had to spike it, or one that they should have ran a play or called a timeout there. You know, I mean, you would think that they are looking to score a touchdown, that they're not just going to settle for a field goal. I mean, we know that Bailey has a very, you know, he can kick, you know, 55-yard-plus field goals, and we've seen him do it before. it's a debatable play whether they should have ran a play there, just hurry up to the line. I mean, in a perfect world, if you can kick a field goal, or, you know, obviously if you can score a touchdown, but if you can kick the field goal and tie the game and not allow Rodgers any time, that's what obviously what you want to do there. But you know what? If whatever the outcome is, however much time is going to be left, it wasn't going to be a lot, you tell your defense to make a stop, to hold them. And they didn't do it.
Why? You expect the defense to make a stop on 3rd and 20?
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. So that's why, in a perfect world, yes, if they could have made it so they kick a field goal as time expires, tie the game, and go to overtime, great. But you just want to make sure that you get the yardage, because they were at the 40, I think, at the time. They got another. There was a third. Second down. It was like a 7 or 8 yard pass to Beasley, I think, who went out of bounds there, stopped the clock. So they still had their timeout in their pocket anyway. And that's why I think people thought that they should have just used a timeout there instead of spiking it and giving up the down. Then on third down, he gets the ball knocked down, and then they kick the field goal to tie the game. But again, it's debatable. You're in, you know, in real time, it's tough to say, like, oh, they should call a timeout or run a play as opposed to spiking it or choose to spike it. Again, defense, stop them. You know, they don't have – I don't think – well, no, Green Bay had a timeout, right? They had at least one or two. But still, you know what? Stop them. Don't let them get in the field goal range. You know, they only have 30 seconds or so to go. Make a stop. And they couldn't do it. They let them connect on that incredible pass, which we'll get to in some detail.
You're at it. You're at it, so no, get to it.
Oh, I mean, just an amazing play. I mean, just an absolutely incredible play. I don't know what else to say. I mean, Rodgers rolling to his left, throwing across his body, Jared Cook, who's been dumped by, again, we talked about him, right? We talked about how, you know, the super athletic, gifted, physically gifted Jared Cook, who's been dumped multiple times because, you know, couldn't establish himself as a reliable receiver, as a consistent receiver. And he's become Aaron Rodgers' new favorite target with Jordy Nelson out. And unbelievable play, you know, just rolling left and just laying it in, just throws a laser perfect placement. You know, Cook, you know, getting his feet down, you know, on the sideline there, catching it with two hands, getting his feet in, and just an absolutely brilliant play. And if they, I mean, that'll be on the highlight reels for years to come. If Green Bay does win a Super Bowl this year, that's the one they'll be talking about for years to come. That'll be like the Manning to Tyree helmet or whatever. I mean, that'll be the one.
And then Crosby kicks the 51-yard field goal twice to win it.
Yeah. The one thing actually I will say, though, and we'll get obviously to the controversy in the Pittsburgh-Kansas City game with the holding call. There was actually – and now Rodgers was like rolling out of the pocket, I guess about to like roll out of the pocket. Maybe that's why he didn't throw a flag. There was a Dallas defender that was literally tackled on the play. If you go back and watch a replay, I forget which Green Bay offensive lineman it was and which Dallas defender, but was literally tackled on the play. And I was actually thinking in real time, like, oh, my God, they got to throw a flag. And – didn't. I mean, again, Rodgers was rolling out of the pockets. Maybe that's why they kept it in their pocket, the referees. But and then, yep, like you said, Crosby, 250-yard field goals in the last 2 minutes. Yeah, incredible. Incredible finish. And Mr. Rodgers bringing his neighborhood to Big D and rolling out with a victory. So
as we anticipated, a game high scoring in the 30s. And there
I actually predicted 34-31. I think because we said last team with the ball, and I have to go back now and check our tape, but I think I may have actually predicted 34-31. It was around there. I know it was around there.
I'm sure one of our listeners can immediately recall what the prediction was, so they can tweet at Hip in the Lip when they listen to this and confirm the accuracy of your prediction. All right.
Well, I did say Green Bay. I did pick Green Bay, and I said I said they would cover, and I think I said they would win too. And I mean, but yeah, not too much defense played in this game, but sometimes you just have to accept, especially in today's NFL, that offense is going to dominate the day. Offense dominated this day, and offense will be dominating again this coming weekend.
Well, they only really dominated half the day because at night it wasn't quite the same type of ball game.
True. No, that's fair. That's fair. Different type of game. Different type of game. I'm not going to say it was great. A defensive struggle. It wasn't like the 49er Giant game from, you know, the NFC Championship game from 5 years ago, where that was literally a defense. I mean, that was just a incredible defensive.
Right. I mean, all right. So we're talking about Pittsburgh, Kansas City, and look. I mean, look, Pittsburgh was moving the ball. I mean, they kicked six field goals, and which was just enough to win and or outlast Kansas City at the end. They didn't have to score a touchdown to win because Kansas City really struggled to sustain drives in this game.
Offense was terrible,
especially in the first half. Like they had the great opening drive, but then after that, they just disappeared offensively. It was I was very surprised.
Smith had a rough game. Kelce had a big drop. Yeah, and they kept trying to go back to Hill. Oh, let's see if we can get Hill. And I guess I don't want to be again hypocritical, so we're going to get to Mr. Tyreek Hill. And I didn't even know this. That's how bad the media is at covering this. But anyway, continue. Sorry.
Well, you brought it up. When you bring these things up, you can't just say we're going to get to it.
Well, I was going to.
When you say we're going to get to it, you get to it when you say you're going to get to it. Just get to it now. What is it?
Well, I don't know if you knew this. I had no idea that Tyreek Hill actually strangled and punched his pregnant girlfriend. And this was so poorly reported on. And, you know, great. I mean, if you want to go out and find something, you can find it. We know. But I don't know if you knew about this or maybe a lot more people knew about it.
When did it happen?
It was actually so you didn't know. It was during his college days. It was before he was drafted. And that's part of the reason
I did know that he had a significant off the field issue before he was drafted.
Because I heard somebody say it on TV. I don't think NBC mentioned it. Did they mention it at all during the game? Did they bring it up? I mean, I was in and out of this game, I'll be honest.
No, I don't remember them saying it during this game. I do remember it being mentioned previously on television, but only the fact that he had an off the field issue when it that was in consideration for when he's being drafted, but I don't remember hearing the specifics.
Okay. I mean, like, so everybody, you know, marveling over Tyreek Hill over the last, you know, month and a half, 2 months as he bursts onto the scene. And I had no idea that he had this in his past. And, you know, that just tells you, again, how bad the media has been at covering this. You know, Ezekiel Elliott, we talked about in the, you know, Dallas and, you know, how the NFL swept that under the rug, you know, as they always do. Apparently, they sent Ezekiel Elliott a questionnaire about what happened. They don't even I think that's actually literally what they did. They literally sent them in the mail a questionnaire. Oh, well, what happened? How did this? What happened? And Ezekiel Elliott has the gall to say, like, oh, suspend me or don't suspend me. Shut your mouth. Shut your mouth, rookie. Shut up. If they're going to suspend you, they'll suspend you, and they absolutely should suspend you if their investigation reveals that you committed any kind of violent act. So shut up. But Tyreek Hill, I heard nothing about it. I learned this week. I found that there was actually a few articles in the Kansas City Star that I pulled up online after I saw like a little headline on SI.com or something. And but that, again, that just tells you how the NFL, I guess, either muzzles the media or they just shy away from it because they don't want to, you know, make any waves since they're, of course.
Well, what are you going to want them to do about a situation that happened before he entered the league? I really don't know. Look, it's one thing if it happens during the season or while he's in the league, but when they shy the media, like, what do you want them to do about it?
Well, he's a rookie. It's not like it happened 20 years ago. He's a rookie.
But what do you? No. That doesn't answer my question. You said the NFL just, you know, shies away from it or influences the media. But what do you want them to do about it? I don't understand. Do you want them to come out and say this dude?
The criticism is that the NFL, at least particularly here, you want to say, well, this happened before he got to the NFL, so there's nothing that the NFL can do. Look, if you want to say that there should be, you know, there's no rule that they can they can prevent them from coming into the league because of this.
I'm just asking you what you think they should have done that they're not doing. What's the criticism?
My criticism is about how the media did an awful job about reporting this and how they.
So it's the media. Okay.
Yeah, well, that was my initial criticism. My criticism about the NFL is about Ezekiel Elliott. My criticism here is how they did a terrible job reporting on this.
All right. I think I pried out of you finally what I think makes some logical sense.
And the Kansas City Chiefs obviously saying that we don't give a damn about his past. We're going to bring him on our team, and then we're going to praise him. And Andy Reid's going to talk about how proud he is of him. Oh, yeah, very, very proud because he didn't commit a violent crime in the 10 minutes he's been in the league so far. Andy, close your mouth, too. I don't want to – nonsense. Anyway, so Hill, no big plays in this game.
Okay, I think that all makes – I think
critical, and I don't want to shy away from it. And whenever a story's out there, I want to get it out there because –
We know, and the loyal listeners know as well. And that's and I think it's something that we should continue to do because it doesn't get its fair share, so far from it. And it's and unfortunately, you like it or not, everybody's coming back to watch the next week's games, no matter what happens off the field. I mean, that's just the reality of the NFL right now.
That we know.
You know, so
this game apparently very big rating. Both Sunday games had big ratings. I guess this game did a astronomical rating as it was moved to Sunday night. I guess this was a little ploy by the NFL to try and see if they could drive up the ratings by moving the start time of the game to prime time since it was a holiday weekend. And, you know, they, of course, said it was an ice storm. That was the reason. But I'm sure anybody that pays attention knows that that was a bunch of crap. And that they
regardless of ratings or whatever, I mean, I did enjoy watching this game because look, a different style of game than the one you saw before. And that's what makes the NFL interesting. It doesn't always have to be about exchanging touchdowns and more, in this kind of case, a bit more of a chess match. And the types of plays Andy Reid was going to try to dial up to get that offense going. And, finally on the last drive, they get that second touchdown and, just such a brutal, heartbreaking finish for the Kansas City Chiefs because they have to go for two to tie the game. And if they don't get it, their season's over. And I think they said at the opening, Bob Costas, at the opening of the broadcast, they hadn't won a home playoff game, and I don't remember. It was a really long time.
Yeah, well, they're now they've now lost their last five home playoff games. You want to take a guess as to who the quarterback was the last time they won a home playoff game? The starting quarterback for Kansas City that day? You want to guess?
I can't even name more than, five Kansas City starting quarterbacks of all time. So I'll go with Elvis.
You go with who?
Elvis Gerbel. Go.
Elvis Gerbeck. Nope, not Elvis Gerbeck. This guy is a little
Jeff George. Did Jeff George ever quarterback for the Chiefs?
No. I think he was still in the Colts. Jeff George at that point. This was the '93 Kansas City Chiefs. It was a Hall of Fame quarterback, and to some, maybe the greatest quarterback of all time.
Oh, okay, Mr. Joe, huh?
Mr. Joe, indeed. And what's amazing is that Kansas City is known for having such a strong home field advantage, yet they've now lost their last five home playoff games. Actually, the playoff game that I remember that they were, I think they were number one seed in the conference that year. They were 13-3. It was 95. And Steve Bono was a quarterback for the Chiefs. I remember watching this game. And, Steve Bono led him to it. I think it was 13-3, something like that. I think they were the number one seed that year. And they played the Indianapolis Colts in the second round, that's a divisional round. And they lost that game 10-7. Want to guess who the starting quarterback was for the Colts that day? He is now a coach, a very prominent coach.
Jim Harbaugh.
That's it.
I said it before. You know what? We have it on the tape. I said it before you gave the hint.
Okay. All right. Well done. Well done.
You know what helps? You know what helps is that, this is a I have a classic doubles starting lineup of Jim Harbaugh.
And he's on the Colts?
Well, what's interesting is that the figurine – so there's two figurines I'm holding here, a starting lineup of Jim Harbaugh. So it's two pieces. One is when he was a quarterback in Michigan. The other is when he's an NFL quarterback. But interestingly, the figurine, the NFL figurine for Harbaugh is he's in a Ravens jersey, but the card – is in a Colts uniform, which I think is just kind of interesting.
It is interesting.
Anyway, so that's how I was able to connect the dots because of remembering and looking at that card for Jim Harbaugh. Because otherwise, I could not have told you that he played for the Colts.
The Ted Marchibroda led Colts.
My knowledge is based on random starting lineup
figurines,
things like that. Whereas you just know it.
Well, that one I recall watching that game. And then actually the Colts went on to play the Steelers in the AFC Championship game. The Steelers would win. But at the end of the game, the Colts had a chance to win on a Hail Mary. It was 2016, I think. And Harbaugh heaves it up into the end zone. And I thought, and for a second, we all thought that a Colt came down with the ball. And the ball like just hit the ground. But you see them initially get up and celebrating, and it looked like he caught it. Replay showed that it just barely hit the ground. But yeah, that was I was rooting hard because I always loved the underdogs. I love rooting for those underdogs. Yep. I was rooting hard for the Colts and Jim. Came up just that short, but oh well, what are you gonna do?
So yeah, I mean back to that 2-point conversion.
Back to the game.
That's where we are. Back to the 2-point conversion, and they
holding.
They think they convert it. They got it for two. We're gonna go to overtime. Oh wait a second, there's a flag. Holding penalty, and now it's, you know, a 13 or 12 yard 2-point try, and you know that's that. Unless you have Aaron Rodgers at the helm,
did you like the holding call?
I think so. I mean, I didn't want. I mean, like it? Was I happy about it? No.
Well, did you think it was the right call? I'll rephrase.
Yeah, objectively, probably.
I mean, it's tough when, because the ref, what they always look for is, and the falling down thing, it drives me nuts, because if a guy falls down, it doesn't mean he was held. But what they see is his arm, it looks like he's beaten. He's basically grasping at him now with his arm across his chest, and then him falling down on top of it. You just knew a flag was going to come. I mean, I agree with you. I think it was the right call. It's such a difficult call to make there, because obviously the impact that it has, yep. And he probably doesn't get there. Harrison's probably not going to get to Smith if, you know, if he's not held, but it's tough to say it was the wrong call. I mean, I know Kelsey went off after the game. Oh, he shouldn't be.
Kelsey goes off if you like. If you accidentally graze him after a play, I mean, that guy just is a ticking time bomb. Unfortunately,
and he had a huge drop in the game. So you know what? You have nothing to say, Kelsey. I mean, you were first team all pro.
That guy's a tremendous talent. Tremendous talent.
First team all pro this year.
Yeah, I mean, he had over 1,000 yards receiving. He had a great year, statistically.
Huge drop.
He has some Odell in him. Let's put it that way.
I think it was at the very end of the third quarter, and that was a huge play in the game. So the Chiefs go down. A tough loss.
Very tough loss.
And after the hit.
So my Super Bowl pick is gone. My Super Bowl pick is gone. I still have Green Bay in the Super Bowl, so that part is still alive.
You
had New England.
Yep.
So we got one team each, and we'll see how it plays out. But so, look, I know you really want to get to this. So before we go into the conference championship games themselves, you want to talk about the San Diego? Anthony Lynn, Los Angeles Chargers.
Little,
I don't know if you know what I'm referring to, but Anthony Lynn had there was a press conference, and I didn't see the whole thing, but he was introducing himself as the head coach, and he's like, you know, I'm very excited to be the head coach of the Los Angeles Chargers. Oh gosh, that's what he said.
Wait, was that in- really forgot it's now the Los Angeles, not the San Diego Chargers anymore.
Yes, he screwed it up.
That's awesome. I gotta watch that.
it was the lesson.
That's right. Yes.
So they are now the Los Angeles Chargers moving from San Diego.
Hey, it's just NFL greed at its finest is what we got here. You know what's funny is that if LA has not had a football team, and you know, I don't know what your thoughts on this, but LA has not had a football team now since, what was it, after the 95 season that they both left, the Raiders and the Rams. And I think that LA was thrilled not having a football team. Think about how many transplanted, whether it's East Coast or wherever, you have people from all over the place that live in LA. And, you know, whether they're fans of a specific NFL team or they're just NFL fans and they just enjoy being able to watch the best games, you know, whether they have an opportunity to watch their team or just watch the best games, the best national games of the week. And now they get two terrible, or at least one terrible and one, you know, so-so NFL team now in their city. And I guess the first thing that I thought of was, haven't we seen this before? Didn't this fail before, having the two teams there, and they both picked up and left at the same time, and now you're bringing two back? And the Chargers, which who have absolutely no following at all in L.A. I mean, this is a team that's been in San Diego since the AFL days of 1960, formed the AFL, the American Football League. And, you know, San Diego has a pretty rich, you know, I mean, look, they don't have a great history, but they have some notable players. I mean, Dan Fouts, Lance Allworth, you know, San Diego didn't make this. Hey, he was a good quarterback. He was good. You know, the Air Coryell's Chargers and Kellen Winslow and that incredible playoff game against Miami in the early 80s. It was 81 or 82. And then you have, the San Diego team that miraculously, somewhat miraculously got to the Super Bowl. The Junior Seau, Stan Humphries, Natron Means led San Diego Chargers. Bobby Ross, I think, of the coach, right? That gets, they knock off and upset the Pittsburgh Steelers, only obliterated by the 49ers and Young. But at least history. And they've, in that city and a stadium that I think was fine. I don't think there was any issue with that stadium. I actually wrote about this in my one blog post I made a few years ago about how owners now all they care about is new stadiums, new publicly funded stadiums, because they're not making enough money off of their stadiums that are in perfect condition and that are perfectly fine for the fans and for the players and everybody involved. But because they don't have enough luxury boxes, we can't charge enough for our luxury boxes, and we can't charge personal seat licenses, and we can't charge $15 for a pastrami sandwich and $10 for a hot dog. Well, let's just move to a new stadium and get the public to finance, because the NFL doesn't make enough money. It's only $13 billion a year now in revenue. And these owners aren't worth enough. The Spano, whatever his name is, was Spanos, right? Only worth a couple billion dollars himself. So let's get the public to build it for us and pay for it. And you know what, San Diego? Good for you. I salute you, San Diego, for telling them to go to hell, for telling the owner, for telling Spanos and the NFL, you know what? Build it. We want you to stay. We want you here. Build it, please. But build it yourself. If you want us to pay for it, go to hell. And that's what they did. And I love it. Kudos to you, San Diego. I know it's disappointing. And they had, a bonfire, right? The San Diego fans. And, and I understand that the loyal San Diego Charger fans now, whether they're going to continue to root for them in LA.
Yeah. Do the loyal fans get that what you're saying? Or are they just pissed that their team, picked up and left? Like, do you know, is there a consensus on that from the fan base? Do they understand the logic behind why they couldn't stay?
Well, yeah. I mean, they voted down. I mean, it was a proposal, right? A referendum, I think, right? That they voted down. And they said that
okay. So the fans basically, well,
yeah, but it goes through the process to get it on the ballot and to get, to get it to a vote. And the residents of San Diego said, no, we're not doing it. There's nothing wrong with Qualcomm Stadium. You're making money. It's not like you're in the red. Every NFL team makes money. This is pure, unadulterated greed. Get out. Go to hell. Drop dead. And that's what they did. And I applaud them. Now, I am the same guy that was like...
So what's the deal with the Chargers playing now in L.A.? Are they playing in an existing stadium? They're getting a new one built? How's that going to work?
So, they're playing, in Carson City in a 30,000-seat stadium that houses the L.A. Galaxy, right? And then eventually they're going to move to the new big monstrosity, $3 billion, however much it costs, monstrosity, that the Rams and their owner are currently building. And I guess they'll be moving into in a year, two years, whatever.
So was that approved by the residents of Los Angeles to be publicly funded?
I don't know what the deal is with that stadium. I think there is some public money going to it. I couldn't answer that. I mean, that's already done. That's being built. That's definite.
But that was being built before either the Raiders or the Chargers tried to move to LA.
Well, the Rams moved there because they got that approved. That's why they moved to LA, because they got that approved. I'm sure
the Rams, public money.
Public money that's going into it. Yeah.
Gotcha. So,
and now what's interesting, and I didn't realize this either, I guess some NFL cities are helping finance this by putting obscene taxes on their visitors, on their tourists. So San Diego, I guess there was a part of that ballot was whether or not they were going to raise, I guess, like a hotel occupancy tax from currently 12.5%, which is ridiculous to me, to 16.5%. So they basically institute a rental car tax and a hotel occupancy tax to their, you know, to tourists, to visitors, whatever. And that's what's fun, and that's what goes with part of the funding for these stadiums. St. Louis, if you go to St. Louis and stay this in a hotel in St. Louis, you're going to be helping pay for that stadium that is now not even occupied by an NFL team that's hosting tractor pulls and that and whatever. Maybe Taylor Swift, they're going to try and get Taylor Swift to go out there. I don't know. But if you stay in a hotel in St. Louis, you are helping. And I know one of our loyal listeners will be going out to St. Louis, maybe staying in a hotel. So get ready to help pay for that stadium.
Yikes.
I mean, it just – is that not appalling? Is it just me? Like, how is it?
They spend all this money, raises all this money to build these stadiums, and now the Rams stadium in – the Rams' former stadium in St. Louis doesn't have another
nothing
significant purpose.
Tractor poles and swap meets. I don't know.
All right. So let's move back to the games going forward. Now it's conference championship weekend and both games on Sunday. So the first game, 3:05 Eastern start, Green Bay at Atlanta, the NFC championship game. Atlanta is favored by 5. I see that and I'm like, why are the odds makers continuing to bet against Aaron Rodgers?
Yeah,
5 is high. To me, 5 is high.
I guess I'm not surprised. I thought it may come down. I think it probably will come down. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll stay the same. But they start off at 4. Did it start off at 4 or did it start off at 5?
I don't know. It seems high to me.
Look, they're begging you to take Green Bay. I mean, the run that Green Bay is on, absolutely. I mean, everybody still looks at Rodgers. They still look at Ryan as a guy that hasn't gotten it done in the playoffs. And right now the odds makers are begging you to take Green Bay. Take Green Bay. Come on. And I guess we'll say who we're gonna pick. I've been going back and forth on that.
I just said who I pick. I'm gonna pick. You mean to win it outright or to cover?
We'll cover. We'll say cover.
Yeah, I mean, I think Green Bay has a 50% chance to win this game. I think.
Yeah. So last week it was a no-brainer for me to take them against Dallas. And I think the Giants, and it's a shame as a Giant fan. I mean, it made you sick to your stomach watching that game because you think the Giants could have beat them if they would have played them. That game, like I said, went exactly the way I thought. And I had it was really no debate as to whether or not I was going to take the Packers to at least, I picked them to win. This one, though, Green Bay, they're just so banged up. I think they are right now to one of their defensive backs. I mean, Atlanta is just rolling. Is doing his thing. I understand he's playing at a superhuman level. I get it. But I mean that Atlanta team is firing at all cylinders. I mean, I'm hesitant to take Atlanta because you don't trust them. You're just waiting for them to screw up. You're waiting for Ryan to throw a bad pick. We've seen him throw bad picks before, especially in the red zone. He has a habit of throwing bad picks in the red zone. And you know, their defense is nothing special. They do have a pass rusher. I think he got hurt last game, Beasley, right?
Their defense actually looked not bad against Seattle.
It's okay. It's not bad. I would say it's probably a little bit better than Green Bay's right now. Green Bay, you know, their secondary again, it's all banged up. I mean, it was terrible against Dallas. I mean, you got to figure Matt Ryan is going to be throwing for at least 340 to, you know, something yards in the game.
See,
if not
here's the thing about I think Green Bay is exposed in that. Look, Aaron Rodgers can't catch the ball; he can only throw it. And you know, Jared Cook had an incredible game. They have Devontae Adams, who has a knack for finding the end zone. Randall Cobb, I mean, he's like a rich man's Victor Cruz.
Well, is Nelson supposed to play? Nelson, they haven't.
I don't think so. How can you play 2 weeks after you have fractured ribs? I just don't see it.
Okay, I didn't know if they had definitely ruled them out. I know they said that there was.
They have, but I don't think they have. But I'd be surprised. So you have no Jordy Nelson. I just think Aaron Rodgers, he's going to have the same set of receivers he had last week, and they got the job done against Dallas. But
He practiced today, Jordy.
What's that?
He practiced today.
Jordy doesn't play. I'm going to assume that the line is based on that. And I could see where Green Bay might struggle to move the ball because, look, Rodgers is going to make throws, but, you know, talent can only, you know, bring you so far on the receiving end. And, you know, he's not surrounded by, like, you know, all pro guys. So, look, they haven't lost.
Yeah, I don't think his receiver is back in this game. They have an offensive line that's playing great. And, I mean, look, their receivers have stepped up and made plays. I don't think that it's – even if Nelson doesn't play, I don't think that their receivers will hold them back. I think if they lose, it's because they're going to be outscored. I think it's that simple. I think that this could potentially be like a 41-38 game. I mean, that's it seems like it has that written all over it.
It could be. So, I mean, I go with the Packers. That's my – I mean, look, I picked them to make it to the Super Bowl, so.
Hey, you got to go with them.
Go off of that now.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? I'll go the opposite way then. I will go with Atlanta. I'm not going to be cheap. If I'm going to pick them to win, I'm not going to say Green Bay is going to cover. I don't want to do that, so I'm going to say that Atlanta wins. Let's say 38-33 final score. How's that? They cover – or they push.
So
they push.
So you're going for a push. Of course. Cop out.
Of course. But at least I'm picking them to win.
Right.
They said they're going to win and Green Bay is going to cover. I think that would be
– But if you're a betting man, you can only take Green Bay and the points. Or
40-33. How's that? 40-33 final. There you go.
Okay.
Win by a touchdown.
Atlanta to cover. All right.
Yep.
All right, moving to the second of the two games, Pittsburgh and New England. Those a-holes, apparently, New England Patriots.
In the words of Mike Tomlin, indeed.
He had to come out and apologize for trying to rile up his team. Well, Antonio Brown's an idiot for,
oh, my God. What is he doing?
For broadcasting the locker room dialogue on the internet. I mean,
I think his buddy Odell told him to do it. I think Odell said, "Oh yeah,
it's just the most idiotic thing you could, you know." Just think about how much it's going to piss off your teammates. They don't know that you're like live. You know, you're not only taking a video, but you're broadcasting it live on the internet. You know, a locker room's like one of those sacred places, right? When it's just the team, and right after.
Yeah, it was just a selfish thing to do. Stupid.
Get into the game here, so. Look, I'll start over and we'll cut and get this rectified. Okay, so to the game preview, I'm surprised that the spread on this one is so close to the Green Bay at Atlanta line. I mean, it's a point. It's only half a point difference. It's New England's favored by 5.5. New England's rolling at home all year. The Texans exposed New England in the first half of the game, but they have a much better defense than Pittsburgh. I just don't see how Pittsburgh's, barring some crazy, turnovers from New England and like a pick that a return for touchdowns or set up Pittsburgh really well in field position. I just think they're going to be able to hang with New England for four quarters. I just don't see it.
I agree. I completely agree with you. I mean, they're not as good as an offense on the road. It's that simple. I mean, we saw them move the ball last week. We saw Bell, you know, collect his yards, but they couldn't put the ball in the end zone. It was six field goals. I mean, they kick six field goals on Sunday, they're losing the game. I mean, it's that simple. And I just think New England's a better team. I think Pittsburgh, you know, look, they're explosive. We know that. They could score on a dime with Brown. We understand that. They have a great back in Bell and a quarterback who's done it before in Roethlisberger, but they just, for whatever reason, they're just not as good on the road, at least offensively. And their defense is suspect. Their secondary is very suspect. You know, their front seven's okay. They're pretty good against the run, but we don't know. That's not what New England looks to do. They don't look to run the ball. They're going to, you know, New England's going to collect their points. And, you know, I know Hogan may not play, so we'll see, you know, how what the injury report looks like in a couple of days, but you know, they always just find a way, and they'll probably be scoring in the high 20s, low 30s. And if Pittsburgh can hang with them, maybe they'll have a chance at the end. But ultimately, I see this going the way of the Pat.
So we're seeing a seventh Super Bowl for Bill and Tom.
Yeah, we do.
appearance, that is.
Five and a half. Yeah, I guess, is it spread up to six now? Is it five and a half, or is it up to, I think it may be up to six, actually. So, and if I'm going to pick the Pats, yeah. I will pick the Pats to cover as well. I'm not going to, again, you know, say that the Pats will win, but Pittsburgh will cover. I will pick the Pats to win
we're
and
on
cover.
The same we're on the same
side. And I will say final score of, let's say, 34-24. How's that?
I'll go 31-21.
All right. 10-point victory. Prediction by both
the Hip
and the Lip.
So we'll recap the games and begin our Super Bowl preview next week. So turning off of football and on to the National Hockey League.
Oh, and that league.
It is, yes, so we have to give it its due because, yes, there was some significant local news announced yesterday. The New York Islanders head coach of 7+ years, Jack Capuano, is no longer, has been relieved of his duties. And assistant GM, Doug Waite, assistant head coach, right? Doug Waite now steps in as the interim head coach for the Islanders for presumably the remainder of the season. The Islanders at 17-17-8. I believe is their current record.
Still last one of the worst teams in the league. Still in
last in the Eastern Conference. Look, I mean, they set you up to they get you excited for a couple games, and then they remind you quickly why they're so bad. It's a roller coaster of that. It's been that this year, but more bad than good. And so, a topic of discussion that has come up numerous times on this show, over many episodes, is relieving the head coach of his duties, also relieving the GM of his duties. And I know there's plenty to say there because the GM is still, Garth Snow is still the GM as of now. But when you heard this news yesterday, what was the first thought that came to mind?
Stunned. I was legitimately stunned. I really did not. I resigned myself to the fact that, or at least what I thought was going to be the fact that Jack Capuano and Garth Snow were going to be at the helm of their respective positions until the end of the season. And then we would hope that they would clean house, just get rid of everybody, and start anew. So this really was surprising. I mean, considering that I've been very critical of Capuano, I'll be honest, I did not exactly, you know, dance a jig. I mean, was this long overdue? Yes. Did he deserve to keep his job? No. And, you know, is this a move that they had to make going forward? Yes. But the problem is, first off, you have so many questions. Why now? That's the first question. Why now? What prompted this? Now, apparently, the owner, or at least one of the owners, Ledecky, was with Garth on the road trip, or at least in Carolina. They played in Carolina on Saturday. It was one of their more embarrassing performances of the season. I don't know if you caught any of it. I know that that scintillating football game was on, but the Islanders were ahead in that game, and then they ended up giving up, what, like 8 or 9 or 12 goals in the third period or whatever it was. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I guess it was only 4 goals. So they ended up losing 7-4. Their defensive zone coverage was, again, reminiscent of the Mighty Ducks or District 5. They literally played like they had no structure. They were just hideous in the game. It was one of their more embarrassing performances of the season, which says a lot. And apparently Ledecky was there, and apparently he either gave a face to Garth Snow or he said, hey, Garth, this is unacceptable. Something has to happen now. Or if he just told them, hey, fire the coach. You're firing the coach. That's what you're doing. I'm telling you, I'm the owner. You do the coach. So was this at the owner's behest? Did Snow make this? Did he bring this to the owner and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. Can we do this? Snow in his press conference then goes on to say, oh, well, he wasn't in our plans next year anyway. What does that mean? When did you make the decision that he was not in the plans next year? And if you knew this, why didn't you fire him earlier in the season? When the ship was sinking in October, when you maybe could have salvaged the season, does anybody in their right mind think that the Islanders all of a sudden now are going to be, this is going to be a spark? This is going to be a lifting point now for the team? That they're going to go on this incredible run and make the playoffs? Does anybody believe that now that they got rid of their coach? I mean, that ship had sailed a long time ago. That ship had sank. This season is over. And why all of a sudden now? And what does this legitimately mean going forward? What are the implications of this? Does this mean that Snow is going to be picking the next coach? Does this mean that they're going to give him the rest of the season and then just can him too? Are they going to bring in another guy in the middle of the season? Apparently, they talked to Gerard Gallant, the former coach of the Panthers. Talk to him to bring him in at the end of the season, or that they're going to bring him in now? I mean, there are just so many questions that have to be answered now after this move, which was, again, very head-scratching for me. And, and then it calls into question the relationship between the coach and the GM. I mean, we heard, Capuano takes shots at Snow in, press conferences throughout the course of the season when the team would get killed and they would look terrible. And he would say, hey, my personnel, I don't have any guys in the bullpen, the horses in the barn, whatever metaphor he would use to describe how they have, how there's no reinforcements coming and how he has very little to work with here. Obviously, an indictment of Garth Snow and his awful, terrible offseason where he let two core Islander players go and replaced them with Andrew Ladd and Jason Chimera, who both have had miserable seasons. And, of course, Garth Snow has to come across as patronizing as he does, basically treating the fans like they're idiots, making, these very, glib, just, smug, obnoxious comments, trying to think of the one that really got me riled up. Well, first off, he said, unfortunately, coaches bear the brunt of those decisions. And what he meant by that was if a bad play happens in the game, if a guy makes a mistake or he misses an assignment, and then, well, unfortunately, the coaches bear the brunt of those decisions. Not me, the GM. It's not my fault. It's the coach. It's just the coach has to suffer for it. Oh, really? Aren't you the guy that picks the players? Aren't you the guy that gave him his players? That Jack has absolutely no say at all when it comes to personnel. There are coaches that have some input when it comes to personnel. We know Jack has none. We know that Jack has been there for as long as he has because Garth basically had a guy that he can control. He was essentially Garth's puppet. We know that. And the one thing that bothers me also, especially if Garth Snow were ever to remain at the helm throughout the end of the season and into next season, to me, he hitched his wagon to Jack Capuano after the 2014 season. They were coming off of their impressive showing against Pittsburgh in the playoffs. Garth then goes out and has a season than what he had this past offseason. The team regresses. They go on to be one of the worst teams in the league again. And Capuano could have been fired then. I mean, Capuano could have been fired a zillion times. But he could have been fired then. And when he didn't fire him then, he hitched his wagon to them. And he basically said, I'm going to go down with Jack Capuano. I'm either going to rise and we're going to have success and win together, or I'm going to go down with him. And there is absolutely no way that Garth Snow should be allowed to choose another head coach. Again, to me, he should have been fired after the 2015 playoffs when they didn't show up in Game 7 against the Capitals. They collapsed at the end of that season. It looked like that was going to be a special season. They choke at the end. They fall apart. They collapse. They lose home ice. They don't show up at all in Game 7. Capuano still keeps his job. Doesn't do anything again in the offseason. They regressed last year. Yeah, they had 100 points, and they won a playoff series, but anybody that watched them knows why. It knows that the system was not working, that they won last year because of great goaltending and because of pretty at least solid defensive play and a couple of timely goals. But that was a team that everybody knew was in no way close to winning a cup. And then obviously the disastrous offseason, which led to the complete regression of the Islanders. And after everything that we were told, after patience, rebuild, patience, developing prospects, developing our prospects the right way. Yeah. How's the development of Ryan Strom going? Nelson going, who looks like he's among the, team leaders in points, but is as streaky as can be. And he's invisible for good portions of games and disappeared in the playoffs last year. Where are their stud prospects in the minors? Oh, they're not even close to being ready yet. Really? They're bringing up their prospects, and they're first in the league in goal scoring. Matthews is fourth in the league in goal scoring, and Patrick Lane is second in the league in goal scoring. They're rookies. It is, and the thing that is not lost on the media in New York, and I'll give them credit, in every major newspaper in New York, there was an article saying that essentially, Jack was made the scapegoat. He was the one that was thrown to the wolves. But Garth Snow created this mess. And he is the problem. He is the root problem. And until he goes, things are not going to change and improve.
Well, isn't it interesting that you said that the major news outlets that
well, Newsday, the Post, and Daily News.
But like they don't write about
the Daily News about the Islanders. Shocking.
The Newsday writes about the because they have a dedicated beat writer, right? But the other news outlets don't. And I guess you got to give them credit to the fact that clearly they're still paying attention enough to make enough of an assessment that Garth Snow has to go too. Because clearly you have to follow the organization essentially day in, day out, right? I mean,
they don't have anything of significance after a coach gets fired. I know hockey is very much secondary in the New York sports landscape. I get it. We're going to see 17 articles about Yankee prospects, and when the Islanders fire their coach, I mean, it'll still be very much secondary, and you know, maybe you'll get a little blurb, you know, in the
pay. I know, but what I'm getting at is acknowledging that they're giving you sound analysis when they do address it. It's still, which to me says that they're covering it or following it. They just may not write about it a lot because they don't think a lot. A lot of people,
basically. All right, fine.
Versus,
yeah, well, that's fine. But
the Yankees.
But everybody, at least, they recognize that this wasn't all about Capuano. Yes, Capuano was not qualified. Yes, he was in over his head. Yes, he should have been fired dozens of times by now. And Capuano was the right guy to bring in after they fired Gordon because he was good with young players. He knew how to nurture them. He got along. He knew he had to relate to them. He got along very well with them. He was very much a player's coach. He was the right guy at the time. But he was not the guy that was going to get him over the hump, and we knew this. Any Islander fan that paid attention knew this, and we knew this very quickly. He deserved an opportunity after the Pittsburgh series because they played a hell of a series in 2013. But we knew shortly after that he was not going to be the guy to get them over the hump, and then they did no showed in Game 7 a couple of years ago. But Garth is stubborn, and he's so much smarter than everybody, and his arrogance and his it's just – He knew better than everybody. Oh, I know he's the right guy. And now all of a sudden, well, he wasn't going to be the guy next year anyway. What? When did you make that decision? When all of a sudden was he not the right guy anymore? For years, when everybody said this guy's not the right guy. Oh, no, I know. He is the right guy. You'll see. And now all of a sudden yesterday, oh, he wasn't the right guy anymore. Oh, really?
Time for a jig. Time for to dance the jig of the All right.
I mean, we'll see what Doug Waite does with this crew. We'll see if they actually change anything, if they play differently.
We'll have plenty of time in the coming weeks to, you know, amid the Super Bowl and whatever the nonsense we discussed, to look at how this unfolds. So,
but making this move now to me is the quintessential example of how dysfunctional this franchise continues to be. They have owners that are basically witness protection. Nobody knows where they are. They haven't said a word this whole season. And again, I mean, this just made more questions than what it answers. Because now we're all trying to speculate and guess what the hell plan is in place. How do you – I mean, I just feel that if you're going to get rid of Capuano, you have to get rid of Snow too. You can't allow Snow to get rid of one and then say we're conducting a coaching search and let him be at the helm of it. Unless it just means that he's not going anywhere. If it means that, we're all in trouble.
I mean, what can happen between now and the end of the season that results in firing Garth Snow versus just firing him now? That's what I don't like. There's not much he could do at this point.
Either bring in a team president. They've been talking. Oh, we're bringing in a team president. We're searching. We're doing our due diligence. We're writing notes on a cocktail napkin. You know. Oh, I saw Gordon Bombay. I'm going to ask him some questions. Oh, wait, you're not really Gordon Bombay. I mean, like, well, when are you going to finally hire a team president? Bring him in, let him fire Garth, and then let him formulate the front office. Let him bring in his GM. Let his GM bring in the coach. You collaborate however you want to do it, but you have to just put in that hierarchy because every sports franchise that functions in an efficient manner and that is successful has a sound structure in their front office and a chain of command in which there's no confusion, there's no miscommunication. And you don't just have one Yutz who was a former backup goalie that knew nothing about nothing when it comes to running a team, elevated to a position where he had nobody around him and making, you know, just terrible decisions for a franchise.
How about another temporarily struggling franchise, three games struggling, New York Rangers.
The Rangers. Oh, panic in Rangers town. Thank you, MSG. Panic.
So they lost last night to Dallas 7-6. It was 7-3 after two. And yes, Mr. Lundqvist started this game and surrendered 7 goals in 2 periods.
He did.
That's pretty hard.
Man, it is. And especially for a guy who's been a stalwart for that team, one of the biggest stars in this town ever since he ascended onto the scene back in 2005, right after the lockout. He's been a staple. He's been the face of that franchise he's been one of the best goalies in the league, one of the most important players to his team. And now he looks like he doesn't have a clue. He is lost. Now, I think he can get it back. I don't think all of a sudden he forgot how to play the position or that he physically can't play it anymore. But they have a crisis right now because Ront is hurt. They bring in a guy, Hellberg, yesterday. I mean, everybody, I'm sure, in that building is saying, who the hell is this guy? Where'd they find him?
Oh, wait, are you saying we're not seeing a Rick Ankiel or Chuck Knoblauch situation?
I don't think he all of a sudden forgot how to, like, he's just so mentally it's definitely a mental thing. You just lose your confidence and you just feel like you have no idea, which end of the stick to hold. I mean, it gets to a point like where your confidence is shattered. And, we've seen it happen to starting pitchers, as you mentioned. We've seen it happen to quarterbacks. I mean, goalies, quarterbacks, pitchers, I mean, they're on an island. They're by themselves. Yeah, they can have a guy that can coach them, but they are by themselves. And everybody focuses. They key in. And Ranger fans, I think Ranger fans have really not been appreciative of Lundqvist and what he's done for that team because of the fact that he hasn't had the postseason success. He hasn't won a cup. So I guess in their minds, he hasn't had the postseason success that they would want from him, even though he's had some remarkable postseasons. The prevailing myth that a goalie can single-handedly win you a cup, which is nonsense, and anybody that follows and watches the league would tell you that. A goalie is a very big part, but a goalie can't do it by himself and never has. A couple times, J.S. Chigaya brought the Ducks to the finals against the Devils in 2003. I mean, maybe there's a one or two other instances where a goalie was that instrumental. But Lundqvist has had some great postseasons, and Ranger fans still get on him. But I think he will figure this out. I refuse to believe that he's lost it, that he physically can't play, or that he's just so – his confidence is shattered to a point where he just can't regain it. But they have an issue right now because if he's given up – even though the Rangers now are finally healthy, they get back Zibanejad and Buvinit. Forwards all back. But they can't count on scoring 6 goals every game against the Dallas Stars, who have a goaltending mess of their own.
The Islanders get to play the Dallas Stars tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken.
They do. Let's say maybe another 7 goal output by the Stars. And the Islanders Doug Waite's new and improved maybe carry the puck and try and make plays off the rush instead of dumping and chasing Capuano's system.
The Rangers go to Toronto for tomorrow night.
Yeah. Against the upstart, young, fast, skilled, exciting Toronto Maple Leafs. Everybody in Toronto. Signed Jose Bautista to a 1-year deal. Oh, wait, our Toronto Maple Leafs are good. Actually, the Raptors are good. So, in Toronto, they got something to cheer about there. If the Rangers can kind of regain themselves, and let's see what Hank can do to kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together again. I know that nickname is usually reserved for Rick DiPietro, but I think it's appropriate here. Repair the shattered confidence of Henrik Lundqvist. All right, next.
Well, in the coming weeks, we'll get to baseball. I know. I will acknowledge that they announced today the new class of Hall of Fame inductees. There's plenty of time for that. We'll get to that in the coming months or weeks. We'll see how we feel.
Did you watch any of that game?
Get in your Capitals Penguins and then give me the final segment. Introduce the final segment. So what do you want to say about your Capitals and Penguins?
Well, did you see any of it? Did you watch any of it?
I did see a little bit of it. I did not see the end, though. I don't know what else I was watching, but I
didn't. That was in goal scoring. I mean, I guess goal scoring is up a little bit. It's not up significantly, at least on average. But we've seen some crazy games recently. I mean, obviously, the Ranger game yesterday we touched on.
Some crazy games. Jig-worthy.
Semifinal in Pittsburgh.
Jig-dancing-worthy games,
game, absolutely mind-boggling game. 15 goals, though, in that Penguin-Capital game, from 3-0 Capitals to 5-3 Penguins to 5-5 to 7-5 to 7-7. Oh, it's a roller coaster ride and an incredible skill. It wasn't just bad goaltending. You're probably thinking, oh, the goaltending must have been awful. It wasn't good, but it wasn't just that. It was just extremely skilled players making skillful plays, especially Evgeny Malkin, who is really underrated in terms of how good and how talented he is. But I guess this was the third time in the last 20 years that the losing team in an NHL game scored at least 7 goals. So, and if you're thinking, what's the NHL record? I looked it up because I was curious. It's 21 in a game. Twice happened. The Canadiens beat the Toronto St. Patricks. That's right, the Toronto St. Patricks. Back in 1920, final score 14-7. And then later tied by the Blackhawks and Oilers in 1985, I believe, a 12-9 Oiler victory. And that was an Oiler team, of course, that featured some guys you may have heard of, you know, that Wayne guy, Gretzky, right? Mm-hmm. Messier, Curry, Glenn Anderson, Paul Coffey. So some pretty good players on that Oiler team. The Blackhawks, they weren't very good, though. Dennis Savard, I don't know, maybe I can't think of anybody else right now on those Blackhawks teams. So, all right. And good stuff. Good stuff.
All right.
Next. So that's, I'm going to get to the hipster beer of the week in just a moment. I know that's usually our final segment. I'm actually very, and I promise I will not drag this out. Just very quickly, we have our presidential. This will be our hipster moment, a serious hipster moment of Zenith. And I want you, you know, chime in on this one too. If you know, got a thought, cut me off, chime in. So our new president will be sworn in on Friday. Everybody knows. And there was a story that really, because I consider us now, we're part of the media. We are part of the media. We're a very, very small fringe part of the, or the small part of the fringe media, not part of the mainstream, but we are a medium and part of the media now. People listen to us. So I just want to say that when I saw the story that our president-elect was considering kicking the press out of the White House, I was very much bothered and disturbed by that, to a point where you actually wonder if media censorship and, you know, fascist state-style, state-controlled media censorship was on the way. And I just think that freedom of the press is one of the most important rights that we have in this country. It is, of course, a First Amendment right, and one of the bedrock principles, having a free media in this country, and how important it is that we maintain a free freedom of the press and a free media to be able to report, whether it's reporting the news, whether it's investigative journalism, commentary like what we do. And I guess that story now, I guess they're not going to be doing that, so that it's a sense of relief. But considering the war on the press that Donald Trump has begun, and I know we try and stay apolitical. We do. We don't want to get political. But I was very disturbed by that, and I'm glad that that's not going to happen. But there is still concern as to the approach that Donald is going to take with the press, as he's basically started his war on the press already, as any little thing that's written about him, he's automatically responding and going on the counterattack. So hopefully we don't see any, fascist-style state-run censor, or state-sponsored censorship of the media and the press in this country. That would be a shame. So, all right. I just wanted to get that in. Hipster moment of Zenith, of serious Zenith, or moments of Zenith. And with that brings us to the hipster beer of the week. Take it away, Mr. Hip.
Yes. And let's get a little more serious now and talk about beer. So to close it out this evening, Hill Farmstead is the brewery. And the beer, Society and Solitude Number 8, the Lip and I shared, we drank out of the same glass. Yes. We had one at the 4th Avenue Pub before the Islanders game last week, where I picked up the John Tavares starting lineup. And I knew I wanted to try this beer because Hill Farmstead, if you see their beer on tap when you're out in the New York City area, order it. Because their stuff is just top-notch, you know, from sours to IPAs to stouts across the board. They don't can their stuff and distribute. I think you could buy bottles on occasion at the brewery itself there, which is located in Vermont. But you're not getting cans from these guys. So it's really more of a, when you're out and about and you see Hill Farmstead, chances are it's a good beer. Go ahead and order it. The Society in Solitude number 8 is an IPA with oats and wheat, hopped with Simcoe, Citra, and Mosaic. So there you have it. That's episode number 44. Next week, we'll have our two teams left in the Super Bowl and plenty of other commentary to go along with it. So with that said, all right, bye.
All right, bye. Thank you for sticking with us. All right, next.
Yes, bye.
See you next week, folks. Super Bowl.